From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Music was always a good friend to me. It was the best friend in the world. And I think I wanted to hang out with music more than I did any of my school friends.
Country music singer Patti Loveless. We'll meet her in just a moment as we focus our attention on country music in this hour. We'll also take a look at the life and work of the man in black, Johnny Cash. And we'll meet one of the pioneers of bluegrass music, Earl Scruggs. Also, we'll explore the cultural history of an American icon, the Hillbilly.
There's a great line that I read somewhere where it said, deliverance was the most important thing in convincing most Americans that you should never get off the interstate when going through the South.
Patti Loveless has been described as one of the most popular female singers of country music's new traditionalist movement. Her music incorporates elements of old-time honky-tonk and contemporary country rock. Loveless is nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Country Female Vocal Performance for the title track on her latest album, On Your Way Home. One of the songs in the album is called The Grandpa That I Know. It's sung from the point of view of a child attending his grandfather's funeral. Patti Loveless told Ann Strangchamps what she did to try to become the character inside the song.
When I first heard the song, I thought, this sounds like a young man, a young boy that has attended his grandfather's funeral. So my whole approach to the song, when it was presented to me and to think about recording a song, I was thinking about how to try to make it become from maybe an experience of my own. And the only experience really truly I could come up with, which my grandparents, for the most part, I was a very young child. I was like 3 and 4 when most of my grandparents died. But with Emery, my husband and my producer, his grandfather, who they call Papa Cochran, Homer Cochran is his name. Emery would always talk about his grandfather so much to me. And so with memories of and recollection of the conversations we had about Papa Cochran, I sort of took Emery's memories of his grandfather and sort of put it within this song. And that was the only way that really I felt that I could really make it become my own.
Brand new shoes, they hurt my feet. This lace collar's choking me. Cutting off my air supply when I hang my head to cry. When I hang my head to cry. They've got him.
Use your voice differently at all when you're singing kind of an old-time mountain song?
I don't think I really use it differently. I think because I was so influenced as a child growing up that I think I really know where to go whenever I'm singing a song such as Daniel Prayed or A Solo Constant Sorrow, which is on the Mountain Soul record. And, you know, it's another take of A Man of Constant Sorrow. I mean, there's been many different titles to that particular song. It's probably 100 years old or more.
I'm a soul of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my days. I've bid farewell to East Kentucky.
There's a story I read in your press kit, thinking about how this is the music that you grew up with, that said, when you were little, you asked your dad once, "Why do you listen to this music? It makes me cry." There are a lot of really mournful songs in this particular tradition. Why do people like sad songs so much, do you think?
Well, I did. You know, the thing of it is that you probably have to think about, at the time, the age I was, and I think I might have been around 13 or 12, and I was beginning to learn country music of the 60s, like George Jones and Loretta Lynn and Patsy Cline. And I was getting into listening to some rock and roll, of course, getting ready just around the corner of becoming a teenager, which I think I might have been 12 or 13, but I was an older 12 or 13, maybe going on 30. that I think during this time, you know, socializing with friends and everything, that I probably questioned, because I was very moved by the music whenever Daddy would play the records of the Stanley Brothers and Drunken Driver, or, gosh, there were so many songs that would just tear my heart out, and it would bring me to tears. But I found that years later, when I was recording with Ralph Stanley, and we recorded Pretty Polly together, I think this might have been around 94, I believe, 94, 90, 94, 95, and I was just standing there in the studio with him, and as soon as I started hearing him sing, I started tearing up. So I think in the long run, my dad knew what kind of music moved him and what was soulful music. And he was right. I mean, it's very soulful music. And I always call Ralph Stanley the most soulful voice of the mountains. You know, he's the father of mountain music to me.
Oh, Polly, pretty Polly, would you take me unkind? Polly, pretty Polly, would you take me unkind? You'd have sat beside me and tell me your mind.
Opened up her bosom as white as any snow. He opened up her bosom as white as any snow. It stabbed him through the heart and the blood did overflow.
Then he went down to the jailhouse and what did he say? He went to the jailhouse and what did he say? Killed pretty Polly and trying to get up. Way.
Hear the sounds of loneliness. Hear the sounds all around. Since you just hear these sounds from now on.
Here's one song I find really moving on your Mountain Soul album, Sounds of Loneliness. And you actually wrote this song yourself. I think you don't write very many. And one of the amazing things about it is you wrote this song when you were 14, so right around that time that you're talking about. And I just keep wondering, I mean, were you that sad at 14? Does that come out of personal feeling?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with where I come from, and I was still sort of keeping up with one of my friends back in Pikeville, Kentucky. When I was 14, we were living in Louisville, Kentucky at the time, and of course, you know, Daddy was no longer working, and we had to go to Louisville for him to seek medical treatment for many different kind of illnesses that he had developed from working in the mines. And I think for the most part, because I was in country music, because I did the music that I chose to do, when I was going to school, I think there was quite a few kids that I didn't think would quite understand what I was about and what I did. And I didn't really tell too many. I think there was maybe a couple of friends in high school that I even talked to that even knew what I did. Because to me, this kind of music was more of an adult form of music rather than a teenager's music. And Sounds of Loneliness came from, I think, missing back home and missing my friends back in Pikeville, Kentucky, and missing that kind of life. And it was taking me some time, because we moved to Louisville when I was like 10. And it was still taking me some time to get used to the city life.
Was it really different from life in Pikeville?
Very different. Very different, because it seems like once we got in the city, there were so many things going on which my mom and dad were not able to afford. And you know, just seems like basketball and cheerleaders and just everything going on at school that I really wasn't able to be a part of. But, you know, and in the long run, I think I became involved with something that I tended to love more, and that was music. Music was always a good friend to me. It was the best friend in the world. And I think I tended to wanted to hang out with music more than I did any of my school friends. You know, that's not taking anything away. I mean, I had a couple of great friends in high school, but Sounds of Loneliness, when I look back on it, that was my dad's favorite song that I would sit in the kitchen and sing to him. He always wanted me to sing it. It seemed like every time I picked up the guitar, he was saying, "Honey, do that song. Do that song you wrote." And I think he was missing Pikeville as well, and family, and the lifestyle back in Pikeville. And I was going to a little school called Elkhorn City Elementary, that it was, once you got home from school, you did chores around the house, like if mother needed help ironing or mother needed help washing dishes or anything like that. You know, I was always jumping in there and doing it. And the same thing went for the boys when we came home. It's, you know, we didn't think about going to play football or mm-hmm. or cheerleading or anything like that at the time. And that was just not the way life was within my family.
Hear the sound of my heartbeat. It beats so loud, oh, I can't stand it. Oh, that sound, that lonely sound.
There's a song I wanted to end with, because kind of speaks to that sense of history you were alluding to, of being part of a tradition. It's called Last in a Long Lonesome Line. Would you tell me a little bit about that one?
When I was approached with this song, when they played it for me, the one person that came to mind who I'm very, very close to, of course, is George Jones, and I've worked with him. It's just this particular song, you know, that George has done many, many tunes that talks about, I think, his life, his way of living, and, you know, that there's no covering it up, and he just poured his whole heart and soul into it, and that, you know, it was just like an open book. And artists such as he and Merle Haggard, and my goodness, those kind of artists that I feel that are very, very few of today, and the ones that I feel that have really paved those roads, you know, with their souls to country music, and has been great teachers. And to me, this is sort of a tribute to those like George Jones and like a Merle Haggard and Lefty Frizzell. And I mean, there's just so, Farron Young, I even think, you know, was one of them. There's so many that I could name here that this song just kind of brings to mind. But when I was doing it, I approached it like I knew that George Jones would approach this song.
If I appear to be holding on tight, you'd be right. I've been holding on for dear life. For better or worse, I have lived.
Patti Loveless with a song called Last in a Long, Lonesome Line. It's from her latest album, On Your Way Home. Patti Loveless spoke with then Strange Champs.
But it also left him with an acute sense of guilt that plagued him. He talked about it many times throughout his life, that he didn't try hard enough to get Jack to stay behind that day when he went off to the mill, that he should have just grabbed his hand and dragged him to the fishing hole. That never left him, that sense of guilt.
Coming up, the life and work of Johnny Cash. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Michael Streisguth is the editor of a book called Ring of Fire, The Johnny Cash Reader. It's a collection of 32 articles about the man in black, and it includes contributions from Cash himself. Streisguth met Johnny Cash backstage at a concert in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, in 1985.
I was in awe. I suppose anybody who meets Johnny Cash for the first time, the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth time, remains in awe of Johnny Cash. But what I remember most about meeting him was not my own interaction. It was watching him speak with an elderly man whom I assumed to be a retired coal miner or a steel worker. And Johnny Cash was holding his hands and examining his wrinkles and calluses and said, "These are working hands, chopping wood hands." And that really kind of demonstrated to me his concern, his interest in the working person.
Yeah, it was a guy who really knew what he was talking about.
Born in Dyess, Arkansas, to a sharecropping family, he knew hard work.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
One of Johnny Cash's first big hits, a real crossover, was a song he recorded for Sun Records. What was so different about I Walk the Line?
I believe that it jutted from the 1956 landscape. I mean, even though Elvis Presley was dominating the charts with his rock and roll, what Presley was doing had a sheen on it. It was well produced. It was done out of studios in Nashville and New York. And Johnny Cash, in this age of finely produced rock and roll and the pop music of Perry Como and Teresa Brewer, jutted from the landscape. I mean, there was this craggy voice, a lonely voice. And I think that's what caught the ears of Americans.
You were talking about Johnny Cash's background. In fact, in your book, you've got articles about his life as well as his music. There's something in one of the early chapters about his brother, Jack. Can you tell me about his brother's death?
His brother, Jack, was very close to him. He was an older brother. And one Saturday morning, Jack was heading out to a mill where he worked. And he was noodling around, not really wanting to go. And John, J.R., as he was known then, the Johnny didn't come until Sam Phillips at Sun Records dubbed that, was trying to get his brother to go fishing. Let's go down to the fishing hole. Forget about the job. And Jack went to his job nonetheless, and Johnny went fishing by himself. And while Johnny was on his way back from fishing, his father pulled up in a car and said, "Jack's been in an accident. You better come with me." And his father had Jack's clothing, which had been ripped by a saw blade at the mill where Jack worked. And in fact, the blade had also penetrated Jack's stomach, and he died a few days later.
Wow.
And I think this left an impression on Cash, obviously. I mean, who wouldn't be impressed by one's brother's death. But I think that those final days, Jack was coming in and out of consciousness, and he was having visions of glory, of the other side, of the angels and God waiting for him. And I think that helped form Cash's faith. I mean, in seeing Jack's visions, in knowing Jack's faith, many thought that, in his family, thought that Jack would be a minister. Cash developed his own view of his God, and the event, I think, solidified his faith. But it also left him with an acute sense of guilt that plagued him. He talked about it many times throughout his life, that he didn't try hard enough to get Jack to stay behind that day when he went off to the mill, that he should have just grabbed his hand and dragged him to the fishing hole. That never left him, that sense of guilt.
I guess, and you wouldn't want this to happen in your life, but it seems to have helped create the character that people recognized when they heard Johnny Cash sing.
I think you're right. There was darkness in Johnny Cash, and I think, and of course in his music, and I think through experiences such as that, seeing the death of his brother, seeing poverty around him in rural Arkansas, knowing what it was like to flee one's home as a flood approached, as it did in 1937. He wrote the song Big River based on that experience. All of these unsettling experiences, I think, balled up in Cash and produced that darkness that we do hear occasionally in his music. Now, there's also great joy in his music. But I think when we think about Cash, we think about the man in black and what is dark oftentimes about his music.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash. I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone.
The first Johnny Cash song I ever heard, I think, was Folsom Prison Blues. It's kind of the quintessential Johnny Cash song, isn't it?
I think it is, because it first of all, expresses that experience of the individual who's disenfranchised in society. And Cash constantly did that. So he took the role of the prisoner, that lonely prisoner who hears the lonesome train filled with prosperous people chugging by outside the walls of the prison. And it also speaks of redemption, that prisoner is seeking redemption. He's seeking life outside the prison walls. And a great theme through many of Cash's songs is redemption. Of course, Cash has a rebel image, and just taking that character, the prisoner character, is in line with that rebel image. So I think it is quintessential. And I think Folsom Prison Blues remains one of his most memorable songs because of that.
Part of the thing about that recording that is so remarkable is how clearly the prisoners he's singing to seem to identify with him.
He recorded that song on January 13, 1968, for the second time. He had recorded it for Sun back in the 1950s, but when he went to Folsom Prison in California and recorded that, it became probably the best-known version of the song. It certainly did very well in the charts, et cetera, et cetera. But you're right. When he utters that line, "I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die," the prisoners just went nuts. And I think it was just the whole recklessness of the line, the rebellion of the line, the prisoners ate it up.
When I was just a baby, my mama told me, "Son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns." But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
You don't think of Johnny Cash as a political singer, but in fact, he was one of the few country singers who, at his time anyway, was willing to deal with social and political issues. In fact, he recorded a bunch of protest songs.
He did. I mean, he sang songs in protest of the treatment of the American Indian. He sang songs in protest of the condition of prisoners. He sang songs in protest of the Vietnam War and on down the line. And just to continue on that point, one doesn't think of Cash necessarily as being political. But, you know, I'd like to propose that that Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison, which he recorded again in 1968, is really one of the quintessential albums of the 1960s. And I don't think it's given its due. Of course, you know, if I were to ask you, Jim, what is or what are some of the quintessential albums of the 1960s?
Yeah, you might come up with Jefferson Airplane or Jimi Hendrix, but probably not Johnny Cash. I don't know, though. That Folsom Prison might be right up there.
Well, certainly one of the themes of the 1960s was solidarity with the disenfranchised and oppressed peoples. And I think a lot of musical acts in the 60s, and Bob Dylan among them, certainly paid lip service to that issue. But here was Cash in front of 2,000 inmates in solidarity with them. It just doesn't get any more visceral than that. Mm-hmm. And I think is one of the loudest statements on record, social statements on record of the 1960s.
Yeah. Now, Johnny Cash won 3 posthumous Country Music Association awards. They were his first since 1969.
I think that there was a great feeling of guilt on the part of the country music industry that it had ignored Cash for so long. And I think it was make-up time at the most recent CMA Awards.
But is that all it was? I mean, he won for Best Album. He won for the song Hurt. He won for Best Single, Best Video. I've listened to Hurt a couple of times, and it's a pretty powerful thing to listen to.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real.
It is powerful, and if one sees the video, which has been quite popular, and the video, I think, is what has called attention to that song. He is pictured there near the very end of his life, and those images are juxtaposed with images from earlier years when Cash is vital and young. And I think that caused many to reflect on Cash's mortality. The song was written by Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, and originally recorded by Nine Inch Nails. And Cash called it the greatest anti-drug song he ever heard. There's an expression of regret and physical decline based on that drug use. But, you know, I would point people to some other songs on that album, that last album. For instance, the title track, which is The Man Comes Around. And that song was written by Cash. And it's Cash's take on the apocalypse and what that will look like.
There's a man going around taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around.
I think Cash was always at his best when he was writing from his experiences. He had this ability to look at complex events and feelings and distill them and to come up with lyrics that could communicate that quite simply to his audience. And he was always aware of who his audience was. The man down on the farm, the steel worker, et cetera, et cetera. And when Cash began to get away from writing, I don't think his music was as powerful.
But do you think it was that ability that was really at the heart of his ability to appeal to so many different people? And it wasn't just the man down on the farm. He was popular in the rock and roll years. He was popular in the protest years of the 60s and then again in the 90s. A lot of different kinds of people liked listening to Johnny Cash.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think Cash spoke to people, as you say, on all levels. But I think he was able to do that because oftentimes that music came from his soul. It came from his experiences. And he could sing passionately and clearly about those experiences. I think what happened during the American years in the 1990s, which we're discussing, was an attempt to market Cash to a young audience, and that meant pairing Cash with a lot of new music, and much of it was fantastic. And even the performance on Hurt is fantastic. I'm just arguing that it was more perhaps about creating an image rather than Johnny Cash music. The image of Cash, the drug user, the unfaithful husband, the rebel, was sort of taken out of the closet when Cash joined American Records. And that was marketed to a younger generation that listened to music that had a lot of sort of anger and rebellion and hatred in it. So Cash sort of became the godfather of gangster rap in the 1990s.
Michael Streisguth is the editor of Ring of Fire, the Johnny Cash Reader. Coming up, we'll meet bluegrass pioneer Earl Scruggs, and we'll explore one of the most enduring American cultural stereotypes, the hillbilly.
And because it's an image of white people, it doesn't seem unacceptable in the way that images of African Americans or even other groups that used to be seen as different than white, like Italian Americans or Irish Americans.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Bill Monroe is the father of bluegrass music. He invented the style, which took its name from Monroe's band, the Bluegrass Boys. Among the graduates of the Bluegrass Boys were Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, who went on to make bluegrass music popular with their own band, Flatt and Scruggs and the Foggy Mountain Boys, from the post-war years to the age of Aquarius. Earl Scruggs is almost 80 now, but he continues to perform live. Steve Paulson had the chance to sit down with Earl Scruggs when he was here in Madison, Wisconsin, for a concert.
I remember a lot of times I'd get a few tunes in while my mother was cooking breakfast. She had a big, majestic wood stove. Building a fire is what I did in the wintertime. And I'd start a fire in the fireplace and then go build a fire in the kitchen. A lot of times I'd sit behind the stove. It was a good tight corner where the acoustic was real good. Boy, it sounded better in a tight place like that. So I'd sit back there and pick while my mother cooked breakfast.
When did you start to develop your three-finger technique on the banjo that you became famous for?
I was about 10 years old. I started when I was very young, 4 or 5 years old, trying to pick, they call it two-finger, which was a little bit misleading. It's thumb and index finger. And when I was about 10 years old, I was sitting in a room just almost in a daydream by myself, picking a tune that I still pick today. It's called Reuben. And I was picking that tune. Suddenly realized I had a smooth roll going with the middle finger, which we call it three-finger banjo picking, thumb, index, middle finger, and it's like 1, 2, 3 roll, and it changes a little bit. But it made a more even flow. The two fingers finger I thought was good, but the three, you carry the melody and the rhythm along as you play the tune at the same time.
This is a remarkable thing that you're saying. I mean, this technique revolutionized bluegrass music. I mean, some people say this was the origin of bluegrass, and you're saying you developed this style when you were 10 years old.
Well, that's right, and I didn't know what I had, of course, and I'd play around the community with some boys, you know, my friends that we'd get together, and my brother Horace, he played a good guitar, and he and I would play a lot. Then there was an old man. He'd been in World War I, and he lived on the farm, but he played a good old-time fiddle. He didn't have no lead-in at all, and he'd start into, like, Billy Lowground or something. He'd sometimes play it, seemed like, for 10 minutes, and he had no ending at all. He wouldn't hit no shame haircut at all. He'd just play up till he got tired of it and just quit and start laughing. He'd think of some joke. He'd heard him tell same joke over and over in the course of a year. We'd go to somebody's house and play like on Saturday night, a couple, 3 hours, and he'd tell a tune and tell a joke, and he'd laugh as long as you'd laugh, and then he'd laugh a little more, and then do another fiddle tune. So that was kind of the routine he'd go through.
How was the banjo used? How did people used to play the banjo before the three-finger technique that you developed?
Well, of course, you remember Grandpa Jones playing and string bean. It's mainly that type playing. Didn't fit in that well with the band, but this terrific asset to their, like Grandpa Jones and Here Rattler, Here, Here, and that kind of stuff. So when I started playing, of course, what I was playing, I could play with the singers and back them up. I like to play backup as good or better than I do taking the lead. So I put a lot of thought in what I'm doing while somebody's singing. I don't like to play while they're singing, you know, if they got a line. But at the end of the line when nothing's doing, then I'll do a little fill-in or something. So that's what I like to do a whole lot.
And yet this technique that you developed, I mean, this really revolutionized how people could play the banjo. I mean, this was now a lead instrument. It wasn't just a background instrument.
That's right. And of course, what helped the banjo, I think, I feel like I started that thing at that time, but what really helped it so well is other people liked it well enough to start playing it too, so everybody's played a big part in what's made the banjo a full-time instrument in a band now, I think.
Now, you are known as a traditionalist. You are not only one of the founders of bluegrass music, but someone who's preserved that tradition, but you've always innovated along the way. You added a dobro player to your group, but you added the drums later, and that kind of infuriated some of the purists out there, didn't it?
I don't know. It may have, but I never heard anything about it. Everybody that came to the show seemed to really enjoy it, because when we added Josh Graves with the dobro in 1955, the people just loved it. The dobro played a big part, still plays a big part, especially on songs. It's a good backup instrument as well as solo instrument, so it made a good full-time instrument in the group. And later, I like a beat. I like to know where the beat is. The tune will take care of itself if you'll hold the beat. So the drums will play a big part in helping the people know where you are in the song, and it holds it together. So I don't like drums, just drums, period. But if mixed in well, it plays a big part in the show.
Now, some people may not realize that you're the one who actually recorded the theme song for the Beverly Hillbillies, which, of course, is one of the most recognizable tunes in the history of television. How do you look back on that episode? Is that something you're proud of, or what do you make of that?
That's one of the highlights in my life. They call and want us to do the Beverly Hillbillies show, and my wife. We don't mind that word, hillbilly, but I think it should be used with respect. Some of the hillbilly may be that it's too corny, or I don't know. Any music is good if you do it in the right way. So when they came with doing the Beverly Hillbillies, she turned it down when she first came up with it. And to convince us and her, the nature of the show, they flew the pilot, the first show, out and had a showing room there in Nashville, and we went and saw the show, and they assured us that they were real hillbillies, but they were very intelligent as far as common sense was concerned. Education, no, but they would outsmart the doctors and lawyers as far as common sense is concerned. So I think that plays a big part in a person's intelligence, is how much common sense they have.
It's time to say goodbye to Jed and all his kin. They would like to thank you folks for kindly dropping in. I want to invite you back again to this locality. I have a heap in heaven of the hospitality. Beverly Hillbillies, that's what they call them now. Nice folks, you all come back here. Much bye.
Thank you.
Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs and the Foggy Mountain Boys with The Ballad of Jed Clampett, also known as the theme from the Beverly Hillbillies TV show. That song became the first number one bluegrass single in early 1963. Steve Paulson spoke with Earl Scruggs when Scruggs was here in Madison, Wisconsin for a concert. Did you know that the Beverly Hillbillies isn't just the name of a television program? It's also the name of a country and western band from the 1930s. Anthony Harkins is the author of a book called Hillbilly, A Cultural History of an American Icon. It explores the cultural stereotype of the hillbilly. Harkins told Steve Paulson about the Beverly Hillbillies, the band that played country music, or hillbilly music as it was known, back in the 1920s and 30s.
The Beverly Hillbillies is a fascinating story because they were really a completely fabricated group out of Los Angeles, and a radio director out there sort of made them up, said he was going on a trip into the wilds of the Malibu Mountains, which at that time were pretty wild, disappeared for several weeks. People on air said, oh, I don't know what's happened to him. Maybe he's been, you know, lost or something. And then he reappears on air and he has this amazing story that he's come across this pristine village of mountain people who also, you know, of course, are great musicians. And he brings them on the air as the Beverly Hillbillies. And these were all local musicians who did dress up and came onto the road to the station on mules and the whole nine yards.
Now, it sounds like a lot of those musicians back in even the 20s and 30s were aware that this tag of hillbilly was double-edged, and some of them embraced it, and I suppose others did not.
That's right. I think the best way to characterize most musicians' view of the label is ambivalence. That shouldn't be surprising with such an ambivalent term. And many of them accepted it because they needed the jobs and it seemed like it was commercially viable at the time. And it was not yet as derogatory as it would become. Others resented it right from the start. But it's pretty widespread use. I mean, we see that in the Beverly Hillbillies in California and the Hornellsville Hillbillies in New York and the Hillbillies in Virginia. I mean, it's all over the country. In the World War II years, country music becomes much bigger. It becomes spread through soldiers and through Southerners coming to northern and western wartime production jobs. And as that happens and money becomes more important, they become more concerned about what they're going to be called.
And at some point, record producers decide that it's better to call this kind of music country music than hillbilly music.
That's right. That really starts, well, in the very late 40s into the 1950s, much of it driven by country performers like Roy Acuff, Ernest Tubb, other big stars, who simply reject the label and say they don't want to be associated with it any longer.
Now, we have to talk about the 1972 film Deliverance, mm-hmm. which proved to have an enormous influence on attitudes about people, Southerners from rural areas, and it was not a very nice picture either.
Absolutely. There's a great line that I read somewhere where it said, Deliverance was the most important thing in convincing most Americans that you should never get off the interstate when going through the South. It is a very, very disturbing image of mountaineers as basically savages, sodomizers. And that image was in the book as well. The film, of course, is based on the book by James Dickey.
And these people were not just savages. There was something wrong with them mentally.
They were just off. Cretans as well, right. And, you know, they have a famous... I mean, these images have become so deeply entrenched in American psyche, I guess, that all you have to do is go da-da-da-da-da-da, and everyone knows immediately what that refers to. And that image of the albino boy and the guy with no teeth and all those kinds of things, I think, is very, very powerful.
So why? Why would this one movie have such an impact?
Well, I think it's a very disturbing image, for one thing. I think it also was something which a lot of people kind of secretly, or maybe not so secretly, believed, you know, that most rural people who choose to remain rural, particularly, you know, in the deep backwoods, must be sort of primitive savages who are one step above, if that, you know, wild animals. And yet they have, you know, and here's where country music comes in again, they have this pure, pristine kind of cultural heritage of the string band, the sort of deep religiosity in some cases. But that religion can be like using snakes and drinking poison and things like that. So it all sort of has violence always underneath it, just below the surface.
Now, Deliverance was based on the novel by James Dickey, and I believe he even wrote the screenplay for it, at least an early version of the screenplay. Did he intend to paint such a negative picture of these country folk?
Right. Well, not according to him. It's a complicated story, I think. The storyline is the one that's shown in the film, at least partly, of the four guys from Atlanta taking this trip on a wild river and being met by these mountain folks and being sodomized, and then they have to run for their lives and hunt them down and kill the mountaineers and all of that. That's all in the book. But at the same time, the book has much more of a sense of ambiguity about what is being... I mean, the reason they're taking this rafting trip is that this whole area is going to be dammed up and flooded over. And there is very much of an ambiguity about what is being lost in this rush to modern industrialism and materialism and the sort of depth of the culture that is being washed aside, although that culture is both sort of pure and pristine and frontiersman and at the same time violent and aberrant and dangerous.
You know, I suppose in a strange way, some of those same issues, that dichotomy, is played out in an entirely different cultural phenomenon, the Beverly Hillbillies, the sitcom from the 60s. It plays off on the kind of unsophisticated but cunning country folks who come to live in the big city.
Right, right. And I think the Beverly Hillbillies remains so popular and is so widely known because it captured both sides of the hillbilly character so well. It was both, on the one hand, these were ignorant people who didn't know what, you know, washing machines were and food processors and all that kind of stuff. And at the same time, they were proud and had a clear sense of who they were, had deep decency towards their fellow man, had all sorts of qualities that would allow them to survive anything. And they take all the money, but they don't transform their lives in the way that everyone around them has. And so they don't become deeply materialistic and venal and snobbish and all of those things. So it captures both sides of that. And you have Jed Clampett, who is the patriarch and the sort of noble frontiersman and very deeply religious and has a sense of, very much of a sense of who he is. And then you have Jethro, you know, the son, who is this sort of comic, absurd character who's constantly trying to reinvent himself and is not very bright and gets into trouble all the time. So both sides, both aspects of it are there at once.
Well, and you laugh at the Clampets because they're so naive, but you also kind of realize that really they're better than the people around them.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the show in many ways was a sort of strong critique of modern America and what we had become in this sort of rush to consumerism and materialism and not being concerned about our fellow person and not having a sense of who we were anymore. And the Clampets always have a sense of who they are. They have all this money, but they don't change their clothes. They don't change what they eat. They still drive around in their old beat-up truck. And they're basically decent people, and everyone around them is a terrible person. So that, I think, is what was appealing about it.
Now, it seems that the hillbilly stereotype is still with us. We have this new reality TV show on Fox called The Simple Life. Are you surprised that the hillbilly image has stayed with us all these years, has remained popular and still seems relevant?
A little bit. I mean, I think it's faded. You know, I'd like to say it's still incredibly central to American culture. I think it's a little less so than it was certainly in the 1930s, even the 1960s. But I think it survives because it has this fundamental ambiguity. And because it's an image of white characters or white people, it doesn't seem unacceptable in the way that images of African Americans or even other groups that used to be seen as different than white, like Italian Americans or Irish Americans, those all became unacceptable stereotypes. But because these are sort of Anglo-American white people who happen to be poor and rural, it's not seen in the same way as intolerable. And so it survives in that way, I think, although it gets constantly remade and redefined as well.
And it sounds like it's also a way to play out our anxieties about what it means to live in the modern world. I mean, it's that old tension between modernism and old country ways.
Absolutely. I mean, in some ways, it's a fundamentally American image because it's used to both celebrate modernity and living in an urban industrial world of convenience and consumerism, And it's in it shown to be sort of what we've lost in the process of rushing towards this, the sense of having a clear sense of family and closeness to family, closeness to the land, a clear sense of who you are, not just following each new trend or fad, but having a deep sense of and conviction of what you are and what you stand for. So those positive aspects and the negative aspects of both of them, I think, are, you know, reflect this sort of ambiguity that everyone or many people feel living in such a rapidly changing society. And I think that's why the image continues to exist and continues to mean something to people.
Anthony Harkins, he's the author of Hillbilly, A Cultural History of an American Icon. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And this is Earl Scruggs with his version of Dueling Banjos. Best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a cassette copy of This Hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 1221B, Country Music. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickard, with engineering help from Marv Nunn and Lemoyne College's Communication Department.
PRI, Public Radio International.